And here we go again with another edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz and Huff Archives. Mostly on the Huff Archives, I suspect, but who knows? You might catch it on Free Radio as well if you tune in at the right time. Good luck with that. The show is also going to include a flashback. Today is the 20th, as far as you're concerned, while you're listening to this, if you're listening to the date it was intended to go out on. It's actually being recorded one day earlier, but on July 20th, 2025 is where we're filing this show, if you want to pick up on it at any later time. And we're also going to be bouncing back to, flashing back, if you will, to the October 23rd, 2003 show. Features Father Eric Duff and Jan Turner of the Eureka Spit Jetty crisis, where homeless people were evicted en masse from the South Spit Jetty on what Father Eric Duff claims was a false health pretext. That was seconded by attorney Jan Turner. You get to hear both of them. You're also going to be able to hear David Silva, Skidmark Bob, and a bunch of other folks, but I'll give you a few more details if you weather this current edition, which is mostly going to be some stuff I'm reading, mostly about police abuse and probably some articles about homelessness and whatever I can dredge up on a relatively short notice. So stay with me and you'll find out, and so will I.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me naff. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
And for songs of social significance, we have more by One Year On, The Apocalypse in Review, which we're going to continue to follow. David Rovick's description of the Gaza genocide. And you're going to hear his commentary and his music. And you may have heard it before. I've played it before on this show at different points. I don't know if we've played each of these songs. And certainly his commentary may be a bit new in the sense that I'm new to me anyway. You'll hear some of that as well. So let's begin. Let's begin with one of his thoughts and one of his songs.
In this crowded strip of Mediterranean coastline, where there used to be a population of 2.3 million, more than half of them children, there were approximately 1,000 journalists. Hundreds of them have since been killed, often very clearly targeted for extermination by the Israeli killing machine, along with their entire extended families. On December 15th, 2023, Al Jazeera cameraman Samer Abu Dhaka joined their ranks.
Samer Abu Dhaka had his camera in his hand. He was wearing his helmet and his vest. Like Shirin Abu Akleh and so many others, he was easily identified as a member of the press. They can call the killing indiscriminate. But this isn't exactly true. When they're specifically targeting certain people in order to silence the news, they're killing off the journalists of Gaza day after day after day after day, hoping they can hide their crimes this way. Ola Atala was slain last week, along with 9 members of her family. They were taking shelter in someone else's home after fleeing Gaza City. Ayat Kadura died alongside an unknown number thus far. Her only dream now was to be killed in one piece so they would know who we are. They're killing off the journalists of Gaza day after day after day after day, hoping they can hide their crimes this way. Mohammed Abu Hatab with Palestine TV, dead with his family of 11. Mostawa El Sawaf was killed in another, along with his wife and 2 sons. Sari Mansour was killed in an airstrike on a refugee camp. Mohammed Abu Hasira, along with 42 relations, slaughtered with another familicidal stamp. They're killing off the journalists of Gaza day after day after day after day, hoping they can hide their crimes this way. They hope that if they kill the messengers, they can stop the message getting out. They can smash all of the cameras, silence everyone trying to shout out to the world that might listen and see the horrors happening beneath the Palestinian skies, the slaughter that for now we can still see with our eyes. They're killing off the journalists of Gaza day after day after day after day, their crimes this way.
In every war of aggression Israel engages in, the Israeli propaganda machine does its best to paint Israel as the party in the conflict that stands for democracy and morality. Regardless of how many of their victims' mangled, tortured bodies fill the mass graves, Israeli apologists and spokespeople will talk about Israel having the most moral army in the world. In the fog of war, with the civilian population hiding in fear from the invading army as it shoots and bombs indiscriminately everywhere it goes, it can be hard to get an accurate picture of what kinds of atrocities are being committed. On December 15, 2023, 3 more victims of the Israeli military in Gaza were young Israeli soldiers. They had been among the hundreds taken hostage by the Palestinian resistance the previous October. In the course of the fighting, they had evidently escaped their captors and were seeking to be rescued by their fellow Israeli soldiers. They had gone out into the open with no shirts on to make sure it was clear that they were not carrying weapons or wearing explosive belts or anything. They were speaking in fluent Hebrew to the Hebrew-speaking Israeli soldiers and waving white flags when they were gunned down and killed one by one. Why? Because the soldiers were under orders, regardless of any efforts at trickery from Palestinians who may be fluent in Hebrew, shoot anything that moves. And this was far from the first time that an occupying army, and specifically this occupying army, would be operating according to that particular
dictate. They were raising a white flag. They were trying to be rescued. They took off their shirts so they wouldn't pose a threat, just like they were trained to do. They were shouting out in Hebrew, "We're the ones you're looking for." But the soldiers didn't hesitate. They just opened fire because it's that kind of war. They were raising the white flag in the wrong place at the wrong time. Did they not know the rules had changed now? Existence was a crime. They were people alive in Gaza, where living is compressed between the time when you are born and the time you get a bullet in your chest. They were raising a white flag, just more evidence that proves the rules of engagement are shoot anything that moves. When you see the broken bodies, of all the children dead, including the ones who were shot point blank at a UN shelter squarely in the head. They were raising a white flag, which moved and made a blip on the screen of their computers. Click the button, let her rip, and blow up the whole building, because you saw someone survive. Because in a war like this, the enemy is anyone left alive. They were raising a white flag.
So I'm going to begin with a story from the Pacific Sun, which is a weekly published up in Marin County. It's a story by Nikki Silverstein, who I've read before and I've had on this show as a, well, I've read her stuff before. The name of this story is Brother's Keeper, Marin Man Suing Police Over the Use of Body Restraint Device. And I'm looking at a photograph as I read this story of a man in a hospital bed with a helmet on, looks like a football helmet, and then a mask and a gag and a white wrapping around his neck. And he's kind of wrapped in a cocoon and straps from the bottom of his feet to the slightly, there's I guess an area of his shoulders that are, you can see visible skin. Otherwise, there's no visible skin. It's, I guess, what they would call a body wrap. And Nikki writes, safety or cruelty, local police repeatedly placed Joshua Little, a Marin resident diagnosed with schizophrenia, in the full body wrap restraint device. The part one of his series, I may be reading part two as well. Michael Little never believed his younger brother's stories about police putting him in a bag with ratchet straps. After all, Joshua Little suffered from schizophrenia, which sometimes caused him to hallucinate. It was just way too far-fetched, Mike said. Josh would tell me the police put a bag over his head. Then he said there's this thing that goes around his body, his arms, his hands, his shoulders, and his legs with straps that hold it together so he couldn't move. In other accounts, Josh described passing out because the straps were too tight, leaving him unable to breathe. He reported to his brother that officers transported him to jail in the device, and he would bounce around in the back of the police vehicle, often getting stuck to the floorboard. Since Josh's teenage years, local police had contacted, arrested, and jailed him on a regular basis. Still, Mike, older than Josh by 2 years, remained convinced that his brother's strange claims were the result of disorganized thinking, a symptom of schizophrenia. He tried to reason with Josh. I respected the police, Mike said. I followed that path of, I trust what the police are telling me. I trust that the police wouldn't do something like that. And I think that was my exact response to Josh. The cops wouldn't do that. They'd be in big trouble if they did that, and they'd be the ones going to jail. Eventually, Mike asked the Fairfax and Novato police departments for his brother's records to find out what, if anything, Josh might be experiencing and mistaking for abuse. Both departments denied his request. On February 22, 2024, Josh died at the age of 36 of a drug overdose in Novato. Although he often faced adversity and his life was filled with trauma from a young age, Josh left behind a family, a brother, mother, sister, and 3 children, and friends who still grieve the sudden loss of a vibrant, kind, and sensitive man. Growing up, Josh spent many years in Marin's foster care system. While he aged out, he sometimes lived with family, but mostly he lived on the streets. While his family always remained close and engaged, Josh's disease caused him to behave erratically at times, and he self-medicated with drugs, especially prior to receiving a schizophrenia diagnosis and a prescription medication. Josh's repeated contacts with local law enforcement weren't atypical for a person with schizophrenia. Study after study demonstrates that individuals with mental health issues are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system. That, of course, that doesn't mean necessarily they're being arrested for real crimes, mind you. Sometimes bizarre behavior can be just quite adequate, especially if you're raggedly dressed. Anyway, continuing with the story, that's true for Marin County. A 2024 report by the Marin County Civil Grand Jury stated that up to two-thirds of the people held in the county jail are afflicted with some form of mental health disorder. It also noted that few treatment options exist after individuals with severe mental health issues are released from jail. Although Mike had tried to get help from his brother from the jail's mental health staff and other county agencies, he said he received little assistance. Once Josh died, Mike set out to learn as much as he could about a system that couldn't seem to offer his brother the care he desperately needed. Perhaps his findings could benefit other Marin families with similar circumstances. In April 2024, Mike began submitting requests for his brother's records. First on his list, the Fairfax, Central Marin, and Novato police departments. Most importantly, he wanted the videos from the police body-worn cameras that captured Josh's arrests. Fairfax and Novato had previously denied him access to the records, and they did so again. Ditto for Central Marin. Vowing not to be deterred, the following month, Mike filed a lawsuit against the town of Fairfax for violating the California Public Records Act. The town hired an outside firm, Bertrand Fox, Elliot Osman, and Wenzel, while Mike represented himself. "I wanted to be clear that I did not seek monetary compensation," Mike told the Pacific Sun. "I just wanted to force Fairfax to provide my brother's records." 5 months later, the two parties reached a settlement agreement that provided Mike with the records, including footage from the police body-worn cameras. Thomas Bertrand, Fairfax's attorney, also represents the Central Marin Police Department and had that agency release Josh's records to Mike prior to any legal action. "What I saw broke my heart," Mike said. "Everything Josh described was real." The Pacific Sun has reviewed police in Marin County jail documents, as well as hours of police video footage. The images are harrowing. Over a four-month period from December 2020 through April 2021, on at least five separate occasions, Fairfax and Central Marin police officers placed Josh in the WRAP, W-R-A-P, a full-body restraint system, a spit hood and helmet. One video showed blood streaming down Josh's face. At times, he can be heard saying he can't breathe. Some officers seem to taunt him. Although law enforcement agencies and corrections departments around the country use the WRAP system, manufactured by the company, quote, Safe Restraints, unquote, many people believe using the device has risks. Lawsuits have been filed for in-custody deaths involving the WRAP. In 2018, Dujan Armstrong, a 23-year-old father, died after being restrained at the Santa Rita Jail in Alameda County. Armstrong's autopsy by the Alameda County Coroner's Bureau found that he died of mechanical asphyxia. Cause? A combination of the spit mask, which prevented him from breathing properly, and the WRAP, which compressed his stomach and pulled down his neck. The Alameda County Sheriff's Office no longer uses the WRAP. Last year, the Missouri Department of Corrections also stopped using the restraint device after the death of an incarcerated man. Most of Marin's 13 law enforcement agencies have and use the WRAP. The San Rafael, College of Marin, Belvedere, and Ross police departments don't have the device. However, Belvedere and Ross indicated that if necessary, a neighboring police department with the device could provide mutual aid. Earlier this year, Mike filed a lawsuit against the Fairfax, Central Marin, and Novato police departments for their use of the WRAP. Again, he's representing himself with attorney Bertrand on the other side. Mike hopes to establish a precedent that would prevent the WRAP's use in California, or at least force these three local agencies to adopt policies to ensure the device is used correctly. "I'm asking for the court to answer two questions," Mike said. "One, do the agencies have device-specific policy in place for the use of the WRAP device, as required by California code? And, two, does this device create a substantial risk of positional asphyxiation?" Mike Little acknowledges that he began his mission to find out what happened to his brother at the hands of local officers. Now he's working to protect the public from what he believes is a dangerous device. The next court date is scheduled for September 11th, 2025. Mickey Silverstein's article, Brother's Keeper, Marin Man Suing Police Over the Use of Body Restraint Device. But there's more. A couple weeks later, on July 15th, Nikki Silverstein wrote another article, and it got published in the Pacific Sun, and it was entitled, Saving or Taking Lives? Controversy Over Restraint Device Used by Local Police. The story begins, critics liken the wrap restraint system to a torture device and point out that it has been linked to some in-custody deaths. Proponents claim it saves lives. 9 of Marin's 13 law enforcement agencies use the wrap. San Rafael, Ross, Belvedere, and the College of Marin Police Departments do not have the device. The wrap, manufactured by Safety Restraints, Inc., includes a locking shoulder harness, a locking carabiner to secure handcuffs to the device, a leg restraint, and ankle straps. In a demonstration video on the company's website, CEO Charles Hammond recommends using the wrap system in conjunction with a spit hood and helmet. During an interview with the Pacific Sun, Hammond admitted that when the wrap is applied, quote, it doesn't look pretty, unquote, but he maintained it is a safe and pain-free method of restraining an individual during a crisis and much better than the alternatives like oleoresin capsicum, OC spray, also known as pepper spray. OC spray is extremely painful and restricts breathing, Hammond said. A taser doesn't feel good. Batons, obviously those are striking instruments, right? The old hog tie, where you handcuff someone, tie their feet together, and then tie their hands to their feet, is awful and big people die on a regular basis. All of these tools that help stop the fight are all pain compliance, he continued. With the wrap, there's not pain associated with its use. According to Hammond, more than 2,200 law enforcement agencies and correctional facilities in the U.S., Canada, and Australia have purchased 14,000 wrap restraints. Next up, Brazil. They are all looking for a better way to stop a fight, Hammond said. In the police videos you watch that don't have the wrap, it's yelling and screaming, stop resisting, stop resisting. Then the fight is on and escalates and the punches get more heavy and more severe. Despite Hammond's estimate that the wrap is used 50,000 times each year, scientific research and data on the device's safety are hard to come by. The manufacturer provides only anecdotal information. A 2013 study by the Institute for the Prevention of In-Custody Deaths, IPICD, relied on 4 police departments that voluntarily submitted 128 use of force and incident reports, some of which had information redacted. The Institute's summary of findings included that users reported the wrap to be 100% effective and that no deaths or injuries were identified. Yet, numerous coroner reports, lawsuits, and media articles describe in-custody deaths involving the wrap. As a result, some agencies have banned the device. We have not ever lost a lawsuit, and the wrap has never been the sole determined cause of death when used correctly, Hammond said. Everything else that's used has severe downfalls and pain compliance components to show how they operate. That's not how the wrap operates. Asking for the court to answer 2 questions, Mike said. 1, do the agencies have device-specific policy? Let me move ahead here. Again, in the midst of the second article that I'm reading here. When asked about Dujan Armstrong, who died in 2018 after being restrained in the wrap at the Santa Rita Jail in Alameda County, Hammond said the equipment had been misused. While the coroner's report did not comment on whether the device had been used correctly, it concluded that Armstrong died of mechanical asphyxia, attributing the cause to the position of the wrap device and the spit mask covering his face. Any tool that you use, there's still a human component there, Hammond said of the incident. The equipment has been used improperly, so in the video from the Santa Rita jail, they put the harness on the neck rather than on their back. And when they put it on the neck and tightened it forward, that's what pulled Armstrong's head forward. Marin resident Michael Little, who is suing the Central Marin Police Authority, Novato Police Department, and Fairfax Police Department for their use of the device, believes that Armstrong's death demonstrates the need for enforceable policies on how to use it correctly. Little's brother, Josh Little, was placed in the rap many times by three Marin police agencies. The legal claim filed against them is for violating Government Code 7286. That code states that law enforcement agencies must maintain a policy that includes, quote, a comprehensive and specific guideline for regarding approved methods and devices available for the application of force. During a court hearing in April, Thomas Bertrand, the attorney representing the three police agencies, disputed Little's assertion, noting that his clients used policy manuals from Lexapol, a Texas company. The Paul policy covers all restraint devices, Bertrand said. It covers handcuffs. It covers the wrap device. It mentions the wrap device in specific places. We do not need a policy on every single type of restraint device. And the reason for that is that the manual would be so lengthy that no police officer could absorb the policies. Actually, the Fairfax and Novato policy manuals do not mention the wrap restraint at all. Central Marin does have specific references to the wrap, but only regarding how to clean and prepare it for reuse. Bertrand declined requests to be interviewed for this article. In Marin, only one of the nine departments with the wrap device has a specific policy on its use, the Marin County Sheriff's Office. Little hopes that his legal action will spur the others to follow the sheriff's lead. Additionally, Little raises concerns about the amount of training officers receive on the wrap. Although it's not an element of his lawsuit, he believes that adequate training on the device can mitigate risks. Hammond agrees, which is one of the reasons his company provides a free 2-hour training session on Zoom when an agency buys the wrap and every 2 years thereafter. Training is also available upon request, he said. Only 2 hours of training for a device like this is nuts, Little told the Pacific Sun. It's grossly insufficient for a device that has a known risk of positional asphyxiation and has been linked to multiple deaths. It's totally different putting it on your training partner than on someone having a mental health crisis on the street. Hammond stated that the wrap is not a complicated device, and he claims that it is not a full-body restraint system. The allegation is that it's a full-body restraint. Really, it's a leg restraint, and the harness is not a restrictive tool or restraint, Hammond said. It's an added component to allow a person to lean back like you lean back in the chair, so you can sit and relax. That's what the shoulder harness is for. Interestingly, the company website, saferestraints.com, also sells the harness separately, describing it as a restraint. If the individual becomes violent, a full body restraint can be accomplished by adding the leg restraint, according to the webpage. Perhaps as lawsuits wend their way through the court system, either for in-custody deaths associated with the wrap device, or to demand specific policies for its use, answers will be revealed. And that's Nikki Silverstein's second article, Saving or Taking Lives, Controversy Over Restraint Device Used by Local Police. And the subline was Policing with Pride, the Wrap, Full Body Restraint. There's been some more writing about the wrap. Here's an article by Brian Nam Sonnenstein, who is a publishing editor at Shadowproof website and a columnist at Prison Protest. An article from 9 years ago, August 11, 2016, he writes, new methods of restraining inmates have deadly outcomes. On August 8, the grand jury in Oklahoma recommended no charges be brought against officers at the Caddo County Jail, where an inmate was pepper sprayed and put in a neck hold by jailers until he died from strangulation. The grand jury did, however, recommend changes to improve jail safety. Such changes include annual reviews, allowing administrators to monitor employee training progress, and examining proper restraint training and improving policies that may be outdated. County officials are said to be considering them. Caddo County is not the only place looking to update and reform the way it reduces harm in jails and community. In fact, the day after the grand jury announcement in Caddo, the AP reported officials in an hour and a half away in Oklahoma County had a new way of handling violent combative inmates. Oklahoma County had just purchased three full-body safety systems known as the WRAP, which officials say will be used as a last resort. The local sheriff told reporters the devices are designed to protect the inmate from harming themselves as well as to protect the employees. The WRAP restraining device is produced by Safe Restraints, Inc., which was founded by former sergeants with the Walnut Creek Police Department in California. The company's website boasts, quote, no deaths or injuries in 20 years of use. The WRAP system has customers of over 300 at over 370 law enforcement agencies or branches in the U.S. and 40 abroad. The WRAP restrains a person in a comfortable seated upright position, this is a quote from their literature, as recommended by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. It creates a papoose effect, a position that has a calming effect for the subject, the company explains. You can watch a video of a company demonstration of the WRAP on this website if you go there. Subjects restrained with the WRAP are not forced to lay down, which is a more stressful position. The seated upright position recognizes one of the safest positions for oxygen recovery, creating no pressure against the chest. Again, another claim in the advertisement. The WRAP comes in two models and various sizes, and while pricing is not available on their website, the website patrol log reports it can cost law enforcement from $795 to $845, this was 9 years ago, depending on the included accessories. But reports of multiple inmate deaths involving the WRAP system call the reassurances of its harm reduction and calming effects, so-called calming effects, into question. 46-year-old James Greer was killed in 2014 when BART Transit police and officers from the Hayward Police Department attempted to subdue and restrain him using the WRAP. Greer was stopped by police after running red lights, even out buying lottery tickets, his family said. In video published by the East Bay Times, Greer performs field sobriety tests for law enforcement. But for a split second, he slowly steps away from the officers, who then surround him as he falls to the ground. Police allege Greer was resisting arrest. On the video, officers restrain him and use tasers as he yells, "What are you doing?" They place him in the WRAP system, and he goes limp. Greer was pronounced dead at the hospital roughly 1 hour after being pulled over. The attorney representing his case believes the WRAP system may have played a role in his death. In June of this year, the mother of 42-year-old Eugene Jimerson Jr. initiated a wrongful death lawsuit against the city of Hayward and three of its police officers. According to the lawsuit, Jimerson Jr. was arrested on April 12, 2015, and placed in the WRAP device. Jimerson was mentally ill and suffering from severe tachycardia, or rapid heartbeat, at a shopping center. Police were dispatched to check on his welfare and found him sweating profusely and speaking nonsensically. His heart was beating dangerously fast, but officers didn't call for medical assistance. Instead, a report by Cron 4 reads, Officer Russell Sharrock arrested Jimerson for being under the influence of narcotics, a misdemeanor, and at the Hayward City Jail, Jimerson was denied admission due to his mental health history. He was transferred to Alameda County's Santa Rita Jail in Dublin. The lawsuit explains Jimerson continued sweating and speaking nonsensically as he waited to be transferred to Santa Rita Jail, while staff and police officers stood by for at least 10 minutes without offering medical assistance. When it came time to leave, Jimerson was placed in the WRAP, which compromised his ability to breathe and further stressed his already taxed heart. He had a heart attack and died in the back of the patrol car. There have been other deaths in the East Bay in which the WRAP system was used. In 2015, Roy Nelson Jr. died in the custody of Hayward police. He was, quote, being detained on a psychiatric hold and attempted to kick out the windows of a police car. He was placed in the WRAP and later died. The coroner ruled his death was caused by, quote, amphetamine intoxication associated with physical exertion. In 2013, Kayla Moore died in the custody of the Berkeley police under similar circumstances while being placed in the WRAP. The RAPS system's website contends it can be safely deployed against juvenile inmates. However, as Ozarks first reported in 2014, the state of Arkansas issued a cease and desist letter to a juvenile detention center. This looks like more than one, using the system. After state juvenile ombudsman Scott Tanner traveled to the Yell County Detention Center to experience the RAP system firsthand, he reported the device made breathing difficult and caused anxiety. He said it, quote, presents a risk for head injury and violates state standards, which say any placement of juveniles must be therapeutic and not punitive. Tanner spoke to juvenile prisoners who consistently described the RAP as a form of torture. Quote, I believe the manner in which the RAP restraint is being used in your center creates significant liability, the ombudsman wrote in his report. This is magnified by deficiencies in both policy and documentation. Based on my own experience in this restraint and the interviews of youth similarly restrained, it is my opinion that the use of the RAP restraint on youth is inappropriate, he wrote. The RAP is by no means the only attempt to innovate and introduce harm reduction into the punitive model of our criminal justice system. As governments continue to fail to provide assistance and treatment to those with mental illness, disability, or substance abuse issues, newer restraint techniques have begun to take shape across the nation, often with horrific consequences. Still, the New York City Police takes the cake when it comes to improvising injurious uses of force and restraint, removing a step entirely by placing people in body bags upon arrest. As Gothamist reported in May, the NYPD used body bags to make 122 arrests between January 1st and April 20th of 2016, more than once a day. And back to more on the RAP in a minute, but a few minutes, actually, but here's David Rovix, a little music and a little commentary.
Episode 2, Autumn 2023. Over many decades, Israeli regimes have had a severely vengeful orientation when it comes to maintaining Jewish rule over Palestinians and when it comes to maintaining Israeli hegemony over other countries in the region, always knowing, as the Israeli leaders do, that if things get out of hand, they can count on the U.S. military to back them up and the U.S. taxpayers to foot the bill for all of their wars. The orientation of the Israeli regime has long been that for every death of an Israeli Jew, approximately 100 Palestinians should be killed in retribution. The U.S. has traditionally had a similar orientation from the so-called Indian Wars to the war in Vietnam. The Nazis had the same orientation. It's common to settler colonial thinking worldwide. By this logic, a year into the war against the people of Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon and Syria, the 100-to-1 death toll goal has not yet been reached. Thus, if this is all vengeance for the Gaza ghetto uprising of October 7, 2023, then despite the total destruction of most buildings in Gaza, along with Gaza's infrastructure, as the Israeli militarists would put it, the lawn has not yet been fully mowed. There is no question to any honest observer that what Israel has been doing in Gaza since October 8, 2023 is genocidal in intent. They are at war with all the people of Gaza and targeting all of them, disproportionately including medical workers of all kinds, government workers of all kinds, civil society of all kinds, all schools, all hospitals, hundreds of journalists. The war has broken records in a world that has already experienced so much unspeakable cruelty. There are now more child amputees in Gaza than anywhere on earth. More orphans. More wounded orphans. The strip has been bombed more than anywhere on earth, including Hiroshima, in terms of tonnage. Gaza is number one in so many of the most unimaginably horrible ways. There is no question that this is a war against the people of Gaza, not a war against Hamas. Unless you're just prone to believing the most outrageous propaganda, in which case you may also believe that the U.S. war in Vietnam was a war against communism, rather than a war against the people of that country, which is what it was. For as the Israeli leadership knows as well as the U.S. leadership knew in Vietnam, When you're fighting a massively popular people's movement, such as that which the U.S. military was up against in Vietnam and which the Israeli military is engaged with in Gaza and Lebanon, your enemy is the people. As massive mobilizations of people were taking place across the world, again, as massive mobilizations of people were taking place across the world in solidarity with the Palestinian people, in some places including daily marches that clogged the streets of places like Copenhagen and London, reporters trying to do an honest job of portraying the depth of the suffering that was being inflicted on people in Gaza, began to widely circulate the acronym WCNSF. With the ferocity of the bombing campaign often leveling entire apartment blocks, with entire extended families inside of them, we began hearing of so many families being erased from the civil registry. In other cases, there was one soul-maimed young survivor, upon whose little body a doctor or nurse would write the acronym WCNSF, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. Very early in the course of Israel's total war against the people of Gaza in October 2023, it became clear that the Israeli regime had no intention of allowing in anything close to the level of food and water that would have been necessary to prevent famine. One head of a UN department after another held press conferences. The Security Council met repeatedly, the General Assembly as well. Everyone who knew anything about humanitarian aid understood this was a terrible crisis, and Israel needed to let in sufficient aid, but they didn't. And 1 year on, they still aren't. The UN warned that sometime soon, despite all the horrors of the bombed buildings burying people alive beneath the rubble, and all the many people dying under such circumstances, so many of them children, what would be coming if sufficient food and water wasn't let in would be far worse. Death on a tremendous scale from famine and disease. Despite the heroic efforts of so many UN workers, humanitarian aid groups, doctors, nurses, and so many more in Gaza and around the world, 1 year into the war, the predictions of the experts are visibly being borne out, with untold numbers of people in Gaza now facing and dying of starvation and waterborne illnesses of all kinds. Immediately following Israel's new bombing campaign in Gaza, Hezbollah, the biggest and most popular political party in Lebanon, joined the fight. By the second month of this war on Gaza, the party that runs most of Yemen, Ansar Allah, more broadly known in the West as the Houthis, did as well, by boarding or attacking ships in the Red Sea that were engaged in trade with Israel. Around the world, there were clearly many people trying to find some way to stop the carnage Israel is carrying out in Gaza and, a year on, in the West Bank and Lebanon and elsewhere. Unions and political parties have passed resolutions, complicit corporations have been effectively boycotted, occasional ports have been blockaded, arms factories have been damaged, and lots of huge marches have taken place involving tens of millions of people at least. Again. Immediately following Israel's new bombing campaign in Gaza, Hezbollah, the biggest and most popular political party in Lebanon, joined the fight. By the second month of this war on Gaza, the party that runs most of Yemen, Ansar Allah, more broadly known in the West as the Houthis, did as well, by boarding or attacking ships in the Red Sea that were engaged in trade with Israel. Around the world, there are clearly more people trying to find some way to stop the carnage in Israel. Again. Immediately following Israel's new bombing campaign in Gaza, Hezbollah, the biggest and most popular political party in Lebanon, joined the fight. By the second month of this war on Gaza, the party that runs most of Yemen, Ansar Allah, more broadly known in the West as the Houthis, again.
And I'm afraid that I had thought these were commentaries followed by music, but apparently not. But their commentaries are not untrue as far as I can see, but they aren't very musical. So let me see if I can find a little something to that we can tap our feet to as we observe the genocide.
Episode 3, 2024. Once it became abundantly clear that the Israeli authorities were going to systematically prevent the vast majority of needed food, water, and medicine shipments from reaching Gaza, some of the few in a position to try other methods did so. The Jordanian Air Force was able to repeatedly deliver shipments of aid by airdrop. Planes from France and the U.S. did this as well. Many people said, daily and correctly, that the Israelis needed to open land and sea access to aid shipments during this humanitarian disaster. But in the meantime, some people organized to raise money for shipments of aid to be delivered by airdrop. The British activist and social media influencer Sarah Wilkinson was one of them. While the airdrops never amounted to much for the people of Gaza as the bombs rained down, it's worth noting that in the past, airdrop campaigns have sustained the lives of millions of people, as was the case during the Berlin airlift of 1948. It can be done. It's very expensive and a crazy waste of resources if any other option is available, but it's possible.
Blockade was imposed, no one could come or go, and in order to successfully throttle off the flow of food and fuel and what's needed to survive to keep more than 2 million people alive, the authorities limited imports to just a few tons that would be allowed to pass through. To try to break the siege on the ground seemed impossible until the world heard the sound. Watch the aviators streaking through the sky to try to find out how much cargo they could fly. Every plane that could be flown, determined not to leave these millions alone, to be cold and hungry or else to be subsumed. They said it was impossible, an endeavor that was doomed. Every 30 seconds a plane would fly away to deliver to those trapped 5,000 tons a day. More than 2 million supplied by air alone, thousands of airdrops flown. Watch the aviators streaking through the sky to try to find out how much cargo they could fly. Planes crashed as they do. 100 people died, but the flights kept coming, no way to put aside the needs of all these people to have something to eat, to have fuel and medicine and shoes upon their feet. It was in West Berlin way back when, and it could all be done again. To save the Gaza Strip, or forever wonder why we just let all the Palestinians starve and die. Watch the aviators streaking through the sky to try to find out how much cargo they could fly.
So here's a story from the, I guess, the Archives of the Street Sheet, which is a homeless paper put out by the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco and sold by homeless vendors across the Bay Area, probably, maybe mostly in San Francisco, not sure. But I often try to get copies and distribute it down here. Wasn't successful last time I went up there, but probably be starting again in August to try to grab some of those papers for distribution. If you want, you can go online and read the stories that are in the papers. Or if you happen to go to San Francisco or the East Bay, if you want to get a copy, a hard copy, you can probably contact me on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with. And you can call me at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Anyway, there's a story in the current edition. It's published twice a month, which is headlined, Homeless-Related Arrests, Citations Soared in These California Cities After Supreme Court Case. And it's an article by Marisa Kendall of Cal Matters, reprinted in the Street Sheet. And here we go. This is what it says. In major cities and more rural areas, arrests and citations rose in the months following last summer's Supreme Court decision. In some places, officials insist the events are unrelated. Homeless residents of some of California's biggest cities are increasingly facing criminal penalties for the actions they take to survive on the street, according to a first-of-its-kind CalMatters analysis of data throughout the state. June 28th marked the one-year anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the case Grants Pass v. Johnson, which upended California's homelessness strategy by allowing cities to enforce blanket bans on camping, even if no shelter beds are available. Immediately after the decision, unhoused Californians and the people who helped them reported seeing an increase in enforcement. But CalMatters reporting, gleaned from more than 100 public records requests, appears to be the first statewide effort to quantify that increase. CalMatters analyzed data on arrests and citations for camping and other homelessness-related offenses for 2024, comparing the 6 months before the June 28th Supreme Court decision to the 6 months after. We found increases in cities throughout the state, even in those where local leaders said they didn't change their policy as a result of Grants Pass. Here are some of the places with the most significant increases, according to police data. In San Francisco, then-Mayor London Breed promised to be, quote, very aggressive in moving encampments following the Grants Pass decision. She delivered. Arrests and citations for illegal lodging increased from 71 in the 6 months before the ruling to 427 in the 6 months after. That's, what, about 5 or 6 times as much, a 500% increase is what the author writes. Even though the Los Angeles mayor, Karen Bass, spoke out against the Grants Pass decision, calling it disappointing and vowing to lead with housing instead of enforcement, homelessness-related arrests increased 68% after the ruling. Citations and arrests doubled in San Diego, which also doubled the size of its police teams that respond to homelessness. Sacramento, the number of citations and arrests nearly tripled from 96 in the 6 months before Grants Pass to 283 in the 6 months after. From January through May of 2025, Sacramento police had already issued 844 citations and arrests, suggesting enforcement continues to trend upward. Stockton issued just 14 homelessness-related citations in the 6 months before the Grants Pass decision. In the 6 months after, the number jumped from 14 to 213. It wasn't just big cities that saw more enforcement. Citations and arrests increased by more than two-thirds in Ukiah on the north coast and more than doubled in Merced in the San Joaquin Valley. The ruling, which found that the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, did not violate the Constitution by banning encampments throughout the city when no shelter was available, accelerated a shift toward a pro-enforcement approach to homelessness. Buoyed by voters fed up with large encampments near their homes, Governor Gavin Newsom used the opportunity to urge cities to ramp up enforcement and pass anti-camping ordinances. The people making the case for enforcement argue it's a type of so-called tough love that's sometimes necessary to get people off the street. If someone refuses multiple offers of help, the threat of arrest might make them finally say yes, said San Diego Police Department Captain Steve Shablosky. Nobody has to go to jail, and I hope everybody takes services, he says. I just don't think that's the reality of where we're at with certain individuals. The type of help officers can offer varies widely by city and situation. In San Diego, the homeless outreach team, which includes police officers, as well as social workers and mental health professionals, is supposed to offer shelter before issuing citations or making arrests. Between May 2024 and May 2025, that team made 357 placements into housing or shelter. Shablosky said people refused help 2,471 times, and they accepted another form of services 3,578 times, from a referral to a treatment program to a ride to an appointment to a new toothbrush. The department does not track how many people wanted shelter but couldn't get it. Apparently they aren't also tracking how many people's homes were destroyed, how much of their property was seized and trashed, and so forth. In Stockton, police take a more hands-off approach. They hand out flyers with 6 phone numbers people can call to reach homeless shelters and other organizations. And get lots of answering machines that way, would be my sarcastic suggestion. But I'm not in Stockton and I haven't tried their numbers. But shelter beds aren't always available. Last year, California had more than 187,000 unhoused residents and fewer than 76,000 year-round shelter and transitional housing beds, according to data compiled by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Doctors, academics, and social workers who work with people on the street often say arrests make it harder for unhoused people to get back on their feet. When someone living outside gets a citation, they often miss their court date. They might lose the ticket or simply forget the date amidst the chaos of life on the street, which leads the court to issue a warrant for their arrest. People with active warrants can't qualify for many housing and treatment programs. Situations people arrested or cited for homelessness-related crimes, so-called, are never charged or the charges are quickly dismissed. But the threat of an arrest can be just as disruptive as the arrest itself. People leave their campsites to avoid being taken to jail, and in so doing lose touch with outreach workers trying to connect them with housing and other services, or with their friends who are actually providing some different kinds of comfort and joint activity that helps them survive outside. In a weird way, it undermines the housing process to such an extent that you end up working for homelessness and against the people who are experiencing homelessness, said Brett Feldman, director of street medicine at USC. Some leaders are pushing back against the enforcement mindset. This week, 2 Democratic Congress members introduced the Housing Not Handcuffs Act, which would prohibit federal agencies from punishing people for living outside if they have no other option. Grants Pass made no difference, say cities where arrests and citations spiked. In the year since the Grants Pass decision, at least 50 cities and 3 counties in California passed new ordinances targeting homeless encampments, according to a recent analysis by UC Berkeley Law students faculty. Some ban camping only in specific areas, such as near schools, waterways, or levees, while others ban camping throughout the entire city. Some cities, such as Fresno, made camping a misdemeanor punishable by up to a year in jail and $1,000 in fines. Cities that didn't pass ordinances started cracking down on encampments with new vigor using old rules. To quantify that crackdown, CalMatters filed more than 100 public records requests to police departments, sheriff's offices, prosecutors, and city and county governments for data on arrests, citations, charges filed, and encampment removals. These requests span a sample of about 35 large and small cities and counties throughout California. When requesting law enforcement data, CalMatters asked each agency to provide a list of the ordinances it used to address homeless camps. In some cities, that included ordinances that specifically prohibit encampments, but it could also include rules that ban sitting or lying on the sidewalk, impeding the right-of-way, storing belongings on public property, and violating city park rules, particularly closing rules or curfew rules. Los Angeles Councilmember Nithyan Raman said she was surprised to see the data showing arrests relating to homelessness increased 68% in her city, jumping from 920 in the 6 months before grants passed, from 920 to 1,549 in the 6 months after. Not all of those arrests led to someone being taken to jail. Some were what is called non-custodial arrests, where the person is released on site, usually without their property, except what they could carry with them. There were no policy changes in how the city dealt with encampments after the Supreme Court ruling, Raman said, but the city continues to expand its list of sensitive locations, such as near schools, where it bans encampments, she said. These top priorities is to reduce unsheltered homelessness and bring people indoors and off the streets, Raman said. Our urgency to do that did not come from the grant's past decision in any way, shape, or form. We were already focused on that. Mayor Bass's office did not respond to requests for comment. But Feldman, who provides medical care in encampments on the streets of L.A., said he saw a noticeable change after the Supreme Court ruling. Suddenly, the areas where his team used to regularly find people were emptied. That was a problem because only about 5% of the team's patients have reliable cell phones. If medics can't find their patients, they can't give them important follow-up care, such as their monthly antipsychotic injection or medicine to treat opioid addiction. As a result, their patients get sicker. I was really tough for a few months, Feldman said, though he believes enforcement has gone back down to pre-grants pass levels in recent months. That's because most people have moved out of the heavily enforced areas, such as around schools, and resettled in places that escape police notice, he said. The data CalMatters obtained from the LAPD does not include 2025 information. San Diego similarly did not pass a new camping ban after grants pass. Its unsafe camping ordinance passed in 2023, and police also enforce older rules that prohibit encroaching on the public right-of-way. Shablowski said grants pass hasn't changed anything in San Diego, despite the correlated increase in enforcement, 524 arrests and citations in 6 months before. That's 524 compared to 1,045 in the 6 months after. That's because the police department added officers to its neighborhood police division and homeless outreach team under the direction of a new police chief, which coincidentally lined up with Grants Pass, he said. I can tell you there's an absolutely zero operational direction that Grants Pass is now passed. Go out there and write tickets, he said. If only it were true. Again, I am not an expert on San Diego. I just maintain perhaps an unhealthy skepticism, but I don't think so. Outreach workers struggle to find clients. Beverly Harding, 58, has been on the streets for about 10 years. For the last year of that time, she was sleeping in a makeshift tent. She pitched in various places along X Street in Sacramento, by attaching tarps to the shopping cart that held her food. She still cries sometimes when recounting her run-ins with police, who she says have confiscated treasured items, including a necklace that held her mother's ashes. An arrest last fall was particularly traumatic. A friend's dog had bitten her wrist a few days before, and she'd gone to the hospital for treatment, she said. When the officers grabbed her injured wrist and handcuffed her, Harding said she almost passed out from the pain. She said she still gets shooting pains through her damaged wrist. "They don't understand," Harding said. "It's not camping, it's surviving. And if you don't have a home, where else are you going to try to survive?" "Anywhere you can." These days, the authorities are moving unhoused people around Sacramento on a daily basis, said Joe Smith. He's the director of residential services for homeless services nonprofit Hope Cooperative and board chair for the county's Continuum of Care, or as I like to call it in Santa Cruz, the Continuum of Carelessness, which coordinates the area's response to homelessness. And I interrupt the reading to mention the listener may hear a certain sarcastic and disbelieving quality. Even as I read to you about these social service workers and care providers, who I believe are massively overpaid, so are the police particularly, but the service providers who are, you know, who are sort of the needles on wheels folks who go out and shoot people up with narcotics, pharmaceutical, supposedly drugs that assist mental illness recovery, but I myself am a skeptic of that particular process. The point is that the funding of these agencies, which could go directly to people simply to, I don't know, pay for their rent, pay for the tents that are being stolen by the police, rent empty buildings that abound in virtually all these major cities, is ignored completely, and instead more and more money is dumped into the notion that if you're homeless, it's really a problem with your psyche, you're a drug addict, you're a mentally ill individual, you're an alcoholic. All the problems that people who have housing have as well. But once, of course, you're thrown out into the world with no housing to recover your privacy in, or to be found in by your friends and so forth, all that is aggravated severely. Anyway, let's hear more from this article. Before I do, my point is to argue that it's harder for outreach workers to find homeless people is one way of arguing against all these homeless sweeps that are happening both in Santa Cruz City and County and in all these other cities that we're hearing about in this article. And that's all to the good to point out how stupid, pointless, cruel, unconstitutional, if you believe in the federal constitution or even the state California constitution. But it still gives the misimpression that somehow these outreach workers are a solution to the problem of homelessness. There's some alleviation of some aspects of homelessness by it, but if one is being led into the misimpression that funding these service providers, so-called service providers, is more important than funding the homeless people themselves or dealing with sort of the really basic underlying reality of vast waste of housing space and the inequality of wealth in the country, then you're really barking up the wrong tree as far as I'm concerned and providing misleading arguments, which although they may have some force in saying, oh, well, the outreach workers can't reach folks, so let them, don't do so much sweeping and seizing and destroying their tents. And I say, sure, But don't do it primarily for that purpose. Do it primarily because of the impact it has on the people that are trying to survive out there. And, of course, it's not just connection with paid social service workers, but all kinds of independent charities and self-help operations, groups like Food Not Bombs and so forth that are concerned both with health, safety, and welfare of homeless folks outside, but also changing the situation that they're in so that that doesn't happen to the next generation. Anyway, it's harder for outreach workers who have housing and other services to offer, which isn't always the case. In fact, for the average homeless person, isn't the case at all in Santa Cruz. To find their homeless clients, Smith saw that firsthand last fall. An unhoused man finally got a spot in Smith's Hope Landing housing program after years of trying to get off the streets. But no one could find him. The program pushed his move-in date back three times in hopes that someone would be able to track him down. The client eventually resurfaced, and Smith was able to get him into housing earlier this month. It was just in time. A few more days, and the client would have lost the spot and had to start the entire process over. Even so, the delay meant he needlessly spent about six extra months on the street. Six extra months of pay for Smith's work, of course. I guess I do mean Smith, the service provider. And there's no mention of how many people are not getting into housing. None of these stats are in this, at least not this section of the article. Smith, who was homeless himself between 2005 and 2011, says he's deeply concerned the increase in enforcement is making other people lose out on housing opportunities. How devastating is that, he asked. Surviving outside becomes a lifestyle for you, and your ticket out comes up and nobody can find you. What a shame that is. In the relatively small minority of cases where that's true, yeah. And let's take another crack at Rovick's 1 year on the apocalypse in review.
On the 25th of February, 2024, active duty member of the U.S. Air Force, Aaron Bushnell, walked to the gates of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. He put his phone down so he could live stream himself as he died a horribly painful death, burning himself alive, as he shouted, "Free Palestine." Aaron was one of at least three people in the U.S. who have self-immolated in protest against Israel's war on Gaza. On the 25th of February, 2024, in protest against a U.S.-sponsored genocidal war, as bombs were falling and exploding all around, burning up the bodies of the children on the ground, huddling in tents and just waiting to die, this young man could no longer stand to hear the cries. On International Drive in Washington, D.C., a young airman walked up to the Israeli embassy. As mothers buried babies who had no milk within, as white phosphorus munitions burned off the people's skin, as the troops were firing on those trying to find bread, as the body count was building up to 30,000 dead. Dressed in his fatigues, there on Embassy Row, he announced into the camera this was where he'd meant to go. An act of desperation and one designed to share the horrors of the crimes being committed over there. Like a mirror to the world, so no one could look away from what's happening in Gaza every minute of each day. He stood in front of the building, as ready as he'd get. He put his phone down so he could live stream it on the net.
when he lit the fire, on the day he chose to die, with no way to stop the slaughter, at least he had to try. As the flames rose up, yellow, red, and blue, did he look up at the cross and wonder what would Jesus do? The Secret Service came to point a gun at Aaron's face. The airman didn't move. He just stood in place. He'd come to make a spectacle. That was understood. If he couldn't stop the war, he'd do what he could. As his body burned before us in an unmistakable sign, again and again he shouted out, "Free Palestine!" On the 25th of February, 2024.
And now concluding this July 14th story, homeless-related arrests. Citations soared in these California cities after the Supreme Court case Grants Pass. And this section of the story is entitled, A Missing Tent Doesn't Mean Someone Has Found Housing. Shortly after the Grants Pass decision, then-Mayor Breed vowed to crack down on homeless encampments. What difference did the 500% increase in arrests and citations make in the city? The number of tents and structures on San Francisco's streets dipped to 165 in June. That's the lowest it's been since the city began counting regularly in April 2019. That's down from 360, then in dropping to June. In April, it had 2024, it was 360. In June 2025, 165. But just because someone has ditched their tent doesn't mean they are off the street. Most people are just sleeping on cardboard or on the street and moving every night, said Chris Herring, a UCLA professor of sociology who researches homelessness in San Francisco and beyond. In Stockton, the city launched a Take Back Our Packs campaign to crack down on encampments after Grants Pass. Around the same time, the police department was recovering from a COVID-19 pandemic, the pandemic-era staffing shortage, and increased its staffing in the departments that typically respond to homeless encampments. Police issued hardly any citations for violating park rules, including camping, drinking, and lighting fires in a public park, or obstructing sidewalks, in the 6 months before the Grants Pass ruling. In the 6 months after, police cited people for these offenses 213 times. Police gave a 72-hour warning before they clear an encampment, said Officer David Scott, public information officer for the Stockton Police Department. If people don't move after those 72 hours are up, officers may cite them. In rare cases, if someone is being combative, police may make an arrest. Instead, combative may mean, like, get your hands off my tent. If you got a place for me to go, where can I go? No place to go? Leave me alone. Ah, resisting, eh? Police also hand out flyers with phone numbers people can call. My phone doesn't work. I've called that number before. I'm on a waiting list there, so what? You can still call the number or get going, buddy. They can call for housing, shelter beds, showers, meals, and other resources. We're always going to be out there, Scott said. We want to provide those resources and help to those individuals that are vulnerable. Notice the phrasing. We want to provide. Sure, I believe they want to provide. We want to provide help. Sure they do. But how many times do they actually do so? And what kind of help is it that's meaningful that they're giving? And what about the most essential destruction that's happening as the police are destroying these encampments? He continues, and we're going to continue the efforts in that area. Whoopee. But at the end of the day, we've got to make sure that our city is safe. This is the mythology of the danger of homelessness, which isn't backed by any police stats that I've ever heard of. It's more of a social prejudice, form of fear of the other. And as clean as we can get it. I don't think homeless people would mind if there were actual cleanup events that were really cleanup instead of clean out events. But of course they aren't. The flyers list numbers for 6 service providers, including one that's listed twice, but there's no guarantee anyone will be able to help with whatever the homeless person calling needs. In St. Mary's Community Services, one of the providers listed had 24 beds available across its men, women's, and recuperative care programs as of June 25th. A week before, it had just 11. None were available for families. Police have no way of tracking whether anyone calling St. Mary's or the other providers gets help. And we've requested, our organization HUF has requested this be made of these police stats and the shelter stats be made available each night so people can see what the story is and the public can understand and so not stop blaming the homeless for their situation and recognize that the funding that's going in somewhere else is the reason why these folks are currently on the streets in significant numbers of cases. And for some people, police interactions don't stop just because they've moved indoors. After living on the streets for almost a decade, Harding recently moved into a community of tiny homes for homeless residents in Sacramento where caseworkers are supposed to help her find permanent housing. Shortly after, Harding and her boyfriend were hanging out in front of a nearby laundromat using the Wi-Fi. She was downloading music onto her phone, and he was downloading games. Harding said they had a thin blanket over them because it was cold. An officer showed up and told them camping wasn't allowed there, and they had to move, Harding said. I said, excuse me, I'm not camping. I live next door. And again, this is the story. Not sure what the outcome of that case was, but this is a story in Street Sheet, the mid-July issue by Marissa Kendall of Cal Matters. Homeless-related arrests, citations soared in these California cities after a Supreme Court case. And here's another story in the same issue as Street Sheet, Coalition on Homelessness versus San Francisco. And this is a case in the courts that's been interesting me for some time. I'm going to read a bit about it. What's at stake? Coalition on Homelessness is a challenge to the city and county of San Francisco's efforts to criminalize homelessness through an array of unconstitutional practices, including confiscating and destroying the personal property of unhoused people without adequate notice or due process, and citing and arresting unhoused people for sleeping in public. Right. In September of 2022, the ACLU of Northern California and the Lawyers Committee for the Civil Rights of San Francisco Bay Area filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Coalition on Homelessness and several individual plaintiffs against the city and county of San Francisco and Mayor London Breed, challenging their unconstitutional treatment of unhoused San Franciscans. The lawsuit sought to end the city's practice of unlawfully seizing and destroying unhoused people's personal property and citing and arresting unhoused people for sleeping in public despite having no shelter to go to. For years, San Francisco has responded to homelessness crisis by pushing unhoused people out of sight, destroying their survival items, and arresting and jailing them for unavoidable behavior like sleeping in public. These regressive mass incarceration era policies do nothing to address the city's affordable housing crisis and only perpetuate homelessness. In December 2022, a federal judge in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California issued a preliminary injunction in the lawsuit, directing San Francisco to immediately halt its unconstitutional enforcement of laws that criminalize homelessness and to stop unlawfully seizing and destroying unhoused people's survival gear and personal property. In granting the order, the court also acknowledged that the city's cruel policies have made it more difficult for people to exit homelessness. In January 2024, The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld this order. In June 2024, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in City of Grants Pass v. Johnson that the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment does not prohibit cities from punishing unhoused people for sleeping in public, even if they have nowhere else to go. That ruling prevented the plaintiffs, people suing the city of San Francisco, from pursuing similar claims in this case, but it did not affect the plaintiffs' remaining claims, which focus on the city's unlawful destruction of the personal property of unhoused people. These claims have survived several motions for dismissal and a motion for summary judgment by the city and are headed to trial during the summer of 2025. That's coming, well, we're in that now, actually. 27th, here's the lawsuit timeline. September 27th, 2022. The Coalition on Homelessness, COH, and seven unhoused San Francisco residents sue the city of San Francisco over its practices in homeless sweeps. COH accuses one city department, Public Works, of violating its own bag and tag policy by disposing of homeless people's possessions, including tents, sleeping materials, IDs, medications, and often survival gear. December 23, 2022, 4 months after they started the lawsuit. In the U.S. District Court of Northern California, U.S. Magistrate Judge Donna Ryu issues a preliminary injunction ruling that the city must refrain from dismantling encampments when no shelter is available. Ryu cites Martin v. Boise, 2018, which held that ticketing and jailing unhoused people for camping violates Eighth Amendment protections against cruel and unusual punishment. August 10, 2023. COH offers to settle its case, that's the Coalition on Homelessness, with the city. In rejecting the settlement offer, the city attorney David Chu decries the offer as political theater. August 23, 2023, 2 weeks later. Both sides argue before the Ninth Circuit. At issue is the definition of involuntary homelessness in the district court's ruling. The panel of judges denies the city's motion to modify previous ruling without prejudice. The next day, August 24th, 2023, the district court denies the Coalition on Homelessness's request to appoint a special master to monitor homeless operations and ensure the city's compliance with the preliminary objection, which, of course, it wasn't complying with. They were still seizing homeless property. September 23rd, 2023, Governor Gavin Newsom files an amicus curiae or friend of the court brief to the Supreme Court of the United States to review the Ninth Circuit's ruling in Grants Pass v. Johnson. This is the great progressive Gavin Newsom showing his real colors on the homeless issue. That case focuses on an Oregon city displacing unsheltered residents living outside. Several other cities file similar briefs looking for the power to get rid of their own homeless by threatening them with jail. I added that phrase, but that's what they were doing. January 12, 2024. Supreme Court announces it will review the Grants Pass case. The city files a motion to stay the Coalition on Homelessness lawsuit pending the Supreme Court's decision. April 11, 2024. The Lawyers Committee of Civil Rights, an organization representing the coalition, files an amicus brief supporting Gloria Johnson, the opposing party in Grants Pass, the one of the homeless people, in other words. Over 1,000 briefs supporting Johnson, including one from the Western Regional Advocacy Project, are also filed. June 28, 2024, Supreme Court announces its 6-3 ruling in favor of Grants Pass, essentially overturning Martin v. Boise. Under the ruling, punishing people for sleeping outside is okay, no longer unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. Coalition on Homelessness's lawyers announce they will continue the lawsuit against the city. A year later, June 8, 2025, about a month ago, Judge Ryu dismisses the Coalition on Homelessness' claims of organizational standing because it was not harmed by the city's unlawful seizure and destruction of property. That is to say, the organization, the Coalition on Homelessness, which is a civil rights group fighting laws that turn homeless people into criminals simply through trying to survive, but they're not themselves on the streets, so they aren't really harmed directly by the city's seizure and destruction of the homeless property, though individual members were. However, Ryu ruled, the judge ruled, the coalition may continue pursuing claims based on associational standing. Not sure what the difference between associational and organizational standing is, but I don't know. Maybe we'll discover that in the years ahead. June 12th, Judge Ryu denies the city's request to toss the lawsuit. She rules that two individual plaintiffs, Sarah Kronk and Joshua Donahue, still have housing, even though they're still at risk of homelessness, even if they're currently housed. In other words, they may be housed at the moment, but they could become homeless at any point. And the trial date is coming up in about 10 days, July 30th. That's the scheduled trial date for the Coalition on Homelessness lawsuit against City Authority of the Public Works in San Francisco, the police department, and the mayor's office. Well, I don't think they're actual. The plaintiffs, I suppose, are the city and county of San Francisco. Whoever represents them, I guess the city attorney is representing that group. I think we're here in time for a little bit of music. I'll try to take a brief nap while we're hearing the music.
On February 29th, 2024, scores of Palestinians were slaughtered by Israeli fire, as in a fishbowl. They were desperately in need of food and water, having been starved by the Israeli siege for months. The truck full of food was used as bait to bring them out from the rubble in which they were hiding so they could be killed. Killing Palestinians in search of food and using food as bait like that had become standard procedure in the playbook for Israel's war against the Palestinian people.
Almost 5 months since the blockade was complete, millions have hardly had anything to eat. Most had now fled to the border with Sinai. The rest who through the bombing had managed not to die were living in the rubble with the other refugees, hoping before they died of famine and disease, trucks might come with deliveries of flour as starving Palestinians were counting by the hour. The army fired at every convoy that attempted to make it to the north, but this one was exempted. It was contracted by the army to come to this point on the map so that they could set a trap. They waited for people to start unloading the aid while they watched from above the pen that they'd made. Then they began to fire at those helpless below to kill their unarmed and starving foe. Scores lay dead or dying all around. People fled the trucks amid the deafening sounds of gunshots and screams of those breathing their last breaths, whose need to feed their families now resulted in their deaths. When people went back to the trucks to try again, it's hard to find the words to even say what happened then. The troops began to fire more, round after round after round. Everywhere you looked, a sea of blood was what you found. And then the soldiers drove their tanks over the dead. And then the Western media just repeated what they said. It was chaos on the strip. We had to let the bullets rain. We can't have starving people grabbing bags of grain. So instead, another bloodbath, one of so many now so far, that makes Gazawadi smell like the ravine of Baba Yar. For a sack of flour, they'll shoot starving children dead, though that's somehow not how the headlines read. Almost 5 months since the blockade was complete, millions have hardly had anything